If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read it, you're misinformed. What is the long-term effect of too much information?
Information, information, I just need some information. I've been dying, is it lack of education? I've been reading without any transformation. I'm addicted, is it overstimulation? Hey.
Welcome to the Sixth Sense Report.
Hear ye, come one, come all. You are listening to the Sixth Sense Report with Joel Nikoloff and Darnell Samuels.
Man, it's the last time I'm going to hear you say that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, man.
We're going out with a bang.
Yeah. As the great Sean Carter, a.k.a. Jay-Z, said, grand opening, grand closing. That's it, man. It's a wrap. So, let's get into this episode on the greatest lie ever sold, by Candace Owens, a documentary on the George Floyd case and Black Lives Matter, produced by Ben Shapiro and what's his organization called again?
Daily Wire Plus.
Daily probably. Wire. Yeah. So, what are the 3 points we're hitting on, Joel, with this one?
So, yeah, the three sort of questions or points we're going to talk through is, was justice served? Was the evidence sufficient for a murder conviction? And then how is BLM spending the donations?
Right.
So before we jump into those, when we started talking about this, doing this episode, I was taken back to to my own actions sort of during this time. So I remember distinctly sharing Candace Owens' her first rant, as well as I think it was Larry Sharp's sort of critique of her initial response. Mm-hmm. And again, I was sharing it as here's two interesting, I'm sort of on social media, sort of hacking it. I share a lot of things, probably most of them I semi agree with. A lot of times I'll share things because I think they're interesting. Not that I necessarily agree 100%. And so I thought this was, Larry Sharp's critique of her was largely, time and place of the conversation. Maybe she's, not doing this in the right place or time, which I thought was, he had some fair criticisms of her. And obviously the whole conservative, largely she fits in that bucket. BLM largely fits in the liberal bucket. And so you've got this somewhat her response as a standard left-right paradigm back and forth. So I was looking forward to her putting out this documentary because I would say I anticipated it being a little more methodical and well-structured than her initial response. Her initial response was largely emotional and critical of, and when I say emotional, just, the heat of everything that's going on, as opposed to building a really, robust position. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. What is your thoughts on, let's say, Candace Owen on this topic before watching the documentary?
I try to keep my distance from Candace Owens, and just take it on a case by case basis. So I was just waiting to see what this was about.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I know she's got a new documentary series on Daily Wire Plus. I'm a little bit interested in following that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I would say I'm similar in that I don't really follow her. I don't keep up with most of her stuff, but case by case, sometimes her opinion, I'm curious to see what it is. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. No, it's good. But I do appreciate, I like people who act with reckless abandon. Like, those people are usually my favorite kind of people, who are reckless. That's what I'm doing the show with you.
Yeah.
I appreciate people that go all in and push the envelope on what's allowed to be said, what can be said, what questions are you allowed to ask. So I know that she doesn't really care. And so I'm like, okay, let me see how she's doing the pod. I want to see what comes up. And so, I'm really excited about this. So let's jump into the first topic.
All right. So from your sense, would you say justice was served, or from your perspective, I should say?
Yeah. So, was justice served? Now, for those of you who haven't watched it, check it out. It's definitely a conversation starter. The issue that Joel and I were talking about and what we want to address was the evidence for the case. So there's new information being brought out that wasn't disclosed by first of all by looking at the tape, and that was the issue. Looking at the tape, and that's how it started, and that's what kind of made me sit up. So, you know, you're slouching, you got your popcorn, you got your drink, you're slouching, and then I see footage of George Floyd in the store, and then I see footage body cam footage from the officers of George Floyd in the whole situation. So yes, we're all familiar with Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd, where we've seen that, but there was footage that I haven't seen before, and there was other evidence being brought to the table. And so at that point, I was just like, whoa. I'm only familiar with the evidence from the court of public opinion. I didn't follow the case.
No, yeah, same. Detail,
but watching the video, and forget what Candace was saying. Forget what the lawyers were saying. Forget what the commentary was. I saw the video. And based on my opinion, looking at the video, there's a lot more to this George Floyd situation than I thought. So was justice served? I don't know, man. I'm not going to say yes. I'm not going to say yes, it was, because there's a lot more evidence going on that wasn't revealed in the media that I'm seeing now, where I was just like, I don't think it was. How about you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you touched on it perfectly in that. The story that I knew from public, you know, and I think I've watched most of the body cam footage. You know, I probably didn't sit through the whole thing, but like getting an understanding of like how the scenario progressed to getting him on the ground. I think I was largely familiar with, like, at least him asking to be put on the ground was something I'd heard before, but putting the whole story together, again, I didn't follow the court case. But it sounds like from watching the documentary, the court case would have been hard to really put together a picture of the sequence of events, right? So even I appreciate her documentary starting with like what happened in the store, talking with the store owner, explaining the relationship that the store owner, they knew him, they were familiar with him, he'd been there a number of times, how they deal with counterfeit money. Like all of that encompassed everything, I thought was like, I never knew any of this, like in terms of like the sequence of events that led the altercation even.
Yes.
Because like the thing that I found peculiar was like the guy's like, normally we tell people, hey, this money's fake, I'm sorry, we can't take it. And if they refuse, we'll call the cops and they can explain the story to the cops. And he's like, this is, no one ever sticks around. They take their money and they leave.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only time he's ever called the cops.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that this is the one time, I was like, okay, that's weird. That's peculiar. And then again, the second thing that, again, I'm just, when we're talking, I know we're talking about justice served, but the whole storyline. So the other piece of the storyline that I really gained from this documentary was interviewing his roommates.
Yeah.
You know, I found that really informative. Like I learned who George Floyd was a little bit, that like, I knew nothing about him at all.
First, I thought it was weird. I was like, okay, sorry. Why are we talking to his roommates? Where is this going? But of course, it was building up to revealing who he was and how.
Well, and what was peculiar was there was a piece of the story where his roommate, I think, was retelling a story of a previous time he had an altercation with cops, and how he was very telling her the story about complying so that nothing happened. It wasn't bad. Yeah. Like it was a different person.
Right.
She was retelling a story about, and you're just like, what is going on? Like there's anomalies here that I don't understand.
Yes. And I think the anomaly is this, that in the video, clearly to me, in my opinion, he was not in his right mind. Mm. He wasn't in his right mind. And then we're going to get to that in the next section. But he wasn't, it was clear watching the video, he wasn't in his right mind. And then in the video, as he was on his feet, he was saying he couldn't breathe. And he kept saying he couldn't breathe. Put me on the ground. I can't breathe. And I was just like, what? Yeah, that's weird.
Mm-hmm. So my punchline to the question at hand was justice served. Social justice was served.
Hmm.
There are many instances where justice was not served, excluding George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I thought her documentary did a good job of, just highlighting a handful of cases where people essentially got dealt mob justice, largely for opposing the cultural movement and then being, you know, pigeonholed as whatever, anti-BLM. Right. So, I mean, just simply put, they talk about a guy who's getting, you know, his store essentially looted, right? Theft, robbery, justice wasn't served. Violence, justice wasn't served, right? How many scenarios can we describe where someone had their property damaged or stolen and justice wasn't even considering to be served? And then to me, the one that was pretty egregious she talked about was the state representative essentially busting up pinatas of the police union and a reporter in their driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, hearing the story as a parent, like that woman having to shield her children basically just because she was married to the police union chief. Right. Like, it wasn't even anything she did as an opinion. Like, it didn't, other than just being married to the police union chief and she was a reporter. I'm guessing maybe she had some more conservative stripes in her, you know, perspective. Mm-hmm. Obviously being married to a police officer, but still just different. And essentially inciting of violence occurring and, you know, no justice being even considered again, because they were in the right side of the social movement. So that's where I look at it. Like, social justice was served. Number of cases of where particular justice was largely just ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And so on that scale, justice was definitely not served. I think I'll save my answer regarding George Floyd to the next section, because...
Okay, what's the next section?
Was the evidence sufficient for a murder conviction? And so I want to touch on something that's unrelated to the evidence, but it's kind of not. There's a clip in Candace Owens' documentary where she... where they're showing, I believe it's the lead prosecutor basically saying, like, hands down, this is a murder, no questions asked, da 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 da. And the guy, the first response goes, have you watched the full body cam footage? And his answer is no. That alone tells me a lot. Mm-hmm. When the lead prosecutor hasn't watched the primary evidence and he already knows the answer. Like, what is the objective here? Right. Is there an agenda? It makes me question whether there's an agenda. And if we take the context of, like, you know, generally speaking, when you go to a court and you're trying to get 12 peers, you try to get 12 peers who have not been influenced by the media, which in this case obviously was not possible.
Right.
Right. You try to have people who are completely ignorant. They have no agenda. They don't know the facts. You're going to educate them on what happened, and they're only allowed to know what happened via the court, not public opinion. And so I think that prosecutor's testimony sort of puts me in the box of saying, I find it very hard to say that this man, Chauvin, was given a fair trial. Now, that doesn't mean that the conviction was right or wrong. I'm just saying the pretext for the trial was tainted. And there's evidence in that guy's testimony being one, in my opinion, that without watching the primary footage to its fullest extent, you already know the conclusion. You're saying it like to anyone, this is obviously a murder charge, and you haven't even watched the primary evidence. Like, again, you're just public appeal. And I'm drawn to O.J. Simpson as being the opposite end of the spectrum, but the same scenario.
Right.
So, what is your thoughts on the evidence?
just more so as it related to the analysis they did on the drugs they found in his system. And so they had a certified medical investigator. He was a forensic criminologist. And so, well, a certified medical, yeah, examiner. And so he talked about how that analysis is done. And so the idea was that George Floyd, when you saw him in the video and he didn't seem like he was in his right mind, he consumed something, some kind of toxic combination of drugs. And so it was like fentanyl and methamphetamine. And it was in a lethal dose. And so one thing, the person who he was with was his potential drug dealer. And so in the court case, he pleaded the fifth and he didn't testify because he didn't want to incriminate himself. So he didn't testify. And so the way how this gentleman, the medical investigator, he said this, 3.0 milliliters is a standard overdose level, right? For methamphetamine and fentanyl. So it's 3.0 milliliters is the standard overdose. And in George Floyd's system, they found 11.0 milliliters. So 3.0 is a standard for an overdose, and he had 11.0.
Basically three times, almost four times.
Almost four times. Yeah, and they even found one of the pills in the police car when they were trying to force him in there. And so, you know, facts are facts, or maybe facts are not facts. And I think that's the issue. Maybe facts are facts or they're not. And so it was kind of weird when you were looking at the medical side of it, but then you were looking at the narrative side of it. And so you have the medical versus the narrative of Derek Chauvin out to get him. And even they show different angles of the knee in his back. So on one angle, it looks like knee on his neck. And on the other angle, it looks like knee in the shoulder, knee in the back. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it made me worried. It made me worried for the way we handle the court system, the way we handle these issues. And so I found it very concerning, to say the least, in regards to looking at that evidence and being like, wait a minute, it seems like one is outweighing the other for sure in the wrong sense.
About you? And to pick up on your point regarding the toxicity, the line that I made a note of was, it said Floyd had an enlarged heart as a result of this dose. Essentially, he had a large heart. The assumption or connection would be to the level of drugs in his system. Yep. Methamphetamine and fentanyl.
Yeah.
And it said there was 150%. No, sorry, not 150%, which is only 1.5 times. 150 times increase in the chance of a heart attack due to the size of his heart.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, this is just another fact that, like, you know, these are the facts of the story that question. Who's at? What was the cause of his death? And I think that's partly why you saw, because I think if I understand correctly, they were looking for a second degree murder conviction, and they got manslaughter.
Yeah,
or reckless homicide, essentially, which I think is the same as manslaughter. That alone would make, like, there's no way he could get convicted on second degree with that much, you know, counter evidence to even potentially, like, other causal factors, right? Because the argument in theory, I guess, could be that while these things were true, the thing that pushed him over the edge was the fact that you know he was lying on top of him, or his knee on his neck, or whatever, you know, the rationale was. And just for context, like, if you punch someone in the head who's got a very special circumstance and you kill him, it doesn't matter that he has a special circumstance, your punch was still the catalyst and you're still convicted of manslaughter. So, you know, I just say that to say that it's, I don't know, man. It's so hard to see stuff like this. I think what you've said is perfect, right? It makes me concerning, or makes me concerned for how we handle court cases.
Yes. But also I would also add like empathy. I think empathy is the key thing, walking in somebody's shoes. And there's empathy for George Floyd in his situation. You know, he died. And that's terrible. We don't want to see people die. And even just if you rewind it a little back to the way he lived his life, you have empathy there for the style, his lifestyle. Not judging, just his lifestyle was just kind of sketchy. But also for Derek Chauvin, my empathy goes out to him. Well, my empathy goes out to him because now, you know, he is locked up, and they said, what, he was like 23 hours a day, no TV. They said no books, and that's what got me.
Tears at a wall.
I don't really care. I don't really care about TV. When they said no books, I'm like, man, Malcolm X had books. Like, you know what I mean? That's how he came out of jail. It changed man. People read the word of God and come to faith. And there was nothing to stimulate his mind. And here he is, he's in jail. He's in jail, doing time, for a case that wasn't handled honestly. Not to say, you know, he can't go to jail, but the case, the way how his case was handled, it was a foregone conclusion. That was it. And so I felt sad for his family. I felt sad for him. That he didn't get a fair trial. And it's very sad. I don't care who it is. I don't really care who it is. We have to be gracious and assume the best and want everybody to get a fair trial. And the way it looked like he didn't get a fair trial.
Well, and you know, the especially the American system, Canada's a little, not quite the same, but the American system is literally designed that 12 guilty people will go free so that one innocent person doesn't go to jail.
Say that again so everybody can hear again.
12 guilty people will go free before one innocent person goes to jail. Like, that's the way the system is designed, right? This is why a jury of your peers, if the evidence is not sufficient, they didn't do their job. You rule against them. Right? Like, it doesn't matter if you think he's guilty. No, the question is, did they prove their case?
Yes.
And if the evidence isn't sufficient, you don't convict. You'd rather let 12 guilty people go free than one innocent person behind bars. Mm-hmm. And I think largely society has lost that, largely because the reasoning is punishment. Like, I want to punish him for a social reason in this context.
Yeah.
Right? And we allow... I mean, I honestly go back to like the way we teach civics in school as part of the problem. But I'm not surprised the more I think about it. When you want to reform the system, are you going to educate people on what that system is?
Mm-hmm.
No, because now they're more informed to say, wait, what you're asking for is wrong.
Yeah.
And so largely our entire civics, legal, all of these systems that have evolved over the last thousands of years from, you know, our kings into governments and into other, if anything, we should understand, why is it the way it is now? Like, what value does that serve? And you know, what is these things that are actually practical on a, you know, for someone who you want to become a voter in some sense, you know, we don't touch those at all. We want to educate you on the social perspective that you should have, not fundamental skills and function, you know, systems or institutions. So, I definitely resonate with what you said, that it's concerning for how we handle cases like this, because in the simplest sense, I'm not saying he was innocent. I'm not saying he was guilty, but the manner in which we handled it meant I can't know for sure.
Right. Right. I agree.
I thought, just to finish up, I think she did a really good job of building the entire story in terms of telling the whole story, right? Like, where's the NBC special that retells the 20-minute event? Like, no, we're not going to have that. But we would have
NBC special
50, you know, 20 years truth, ago, 30 years
truth,
ago.
Truth behind George Floyd.
Right. Yeah. Like, but, you know, telling of the story with like, I want to do honest justice to what happened. Right. Let's say post, nobody was going to do it. Right. Nobody did it to the degree she did, where it's like backstory. Yeah, sure. There's a level of sympathy with Chauvin telling his story. But all I heard was Chauvin and him had previous run-ins. Like, oh, when Chauvin was a bouncer, they knew each other. Like, that was the extent of what I learned about Chauvin. Of anything, I heard he was a bully and, you know, had this many violations. Now, I'm not saying, like, she did. I think if people took her documentary and only looked at her documentary, they could criticize her for, you know, maybe being a little bit too much certain way. But when most of the story on the other side has largely been told through mainstream media, and it's the, you know, horrible, not again, mostly the bad stuff that just fit the narrative. Maybe she left some of those things out. Sure. But she wasn't, for the most part, she wasn't trying to tell the whole story. She was trying to tell the parts of the story that weren't told.
Right.
Other than, I think on Black Lives Matter, she maybe did a little bit more both sides, but, mm-hmm. So anyways, that's, I want to give her dues on that. I think it was informative. I think if conviction was the right thing, her documentary didn't do anything to make it like, oh, she's hiding that he should have been convicted. I think she tried to make the case that he shouldn't have to some extent. But I think she did it through facts. And as far as I can tell, there wasn't any facts that she left out that would go the other way.
Right.
Moving on to our favorite organization.
Who's that?
Black Lives Matter. The entity, not the slogan.
Mm-hmm.
So the question being, how is BLM spending the donations? And I'll start by giving a little bit of context based on my experience in the church charity counting world.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Generally speaking, a charity has some level of restrictions in regards to how it spends its money. You have donations, and then you have to spend those donations within your charitable purpose. One of the things that you generally have to be concerned with donations is something called donor-directed funds. So if you have donations and you want to allocate them to particular causes, you need to do that ahead of time and allow people to choose those, what they call restrictions, as opposed to allow people to send you money with conditions. Basically, donor-directed funds are illegal. So outside of collecting money with predetermined restrictions or you know, in line for your organization, you then must spend it in line with your charitable purpose. Part of that would be sending it to similar charities. You can't, for example, in Canada, US could be slightly different, but I'll assume it's the same. In Canada, a charity can send money to another charity, but if I'm sending money to a nonprofit, I need to have proof that they're spending that money in line with my charitable purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Or a for-profit entity or an individual. I can't just give them money to execute what I want them to. They need to actually demonstrate that the money I gave them was spent only on my charitable purposes. Now, if I'm sending money to another charity, largely I need to demonstrate that that charity is also in line with my charitable purpose, but there's a little more leniency there because that person could have got a donation by giving it to that charity instead of giving it to yours. So in the light of Black Lives Matter as a charity, nonprofit, receiving donations, giving tax receipts, there's a level of regulation regarding how those charities are run. And it comes down to actually the way you view the board. The board is considered trustees for the public benefit mm-hmm. that a charity is supposed to be creating. And so largely the trustees of a charity are very personally responsible for the actions of the charity. If the charity was doing something fraudulent, the directors of the charity are responsible. Again, unless you could prove that an employee was acting rogue and it was, you know, isolated to the one employee's actions. And there was no reason why you should have caught it, let's say. But, you know, at the end of the day, the board members, the people who created these charities are largely responsible for the actions that they and where the money went, and did it meet the necessary regulations? So yeah. Anything I said there that wasn't clear, you have a question?
Yeah, no, no, I was going to ask you, what was your opinion? Cause you know, we do cover events that impact Canadians. So how does this George Floyd situation impact Canadians? Well, of course it was impacted us worldwide. We actually, I remember I did the episode with Sam Say and Danfy on his podcast when everybody was posting the black squares, and that was a dialogue. Yeah, that was
good. I really like that conversation.
Yeah. We'll have to put that in the show notes. It was a, you know, that was a couple of days after the incident. Yeah, after his murder, and everybody was posting black squares, and so me, Sam, saying
Juneteenth, right? Is that what they did it for?
Yeah, that too. I think
that was the black square day, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it was a black square day, and so we talked about that. But also another way how it impacts us is, so there was $8 million, right? So they raised $80 million. So first of all, Black Lives Matter raised $80 million from July 1st, 2020 to June 30th, 2021, right? And this is from their 990 IRS findings, $80 million in that short period of time. And so it showed that $8 million was sent to an organization, M4BJ, to purchase a $6.3 million 10,000 square foot property in downtown Toronto. And that was in our news, kind of like an organization to help house the movement for Black Lives Matter. And so I guess the question for that I've asked about Black Lives Matter is, what have they done with the money to help
Black Lives?
Black Lives, yeah, to help Black Lives. So if someone gave me $80 million, what would I use to
what do you think the first thing you would do would be?
I would definitely build schools for sure. I would start with kids
education.
Yeah, with the level of education, I would start my own schools, and it wouldn't be black schools. It would be schools for anybody who wants to learn. I believe that education is not neutral. No education system is neutral. So if you have your money, you want to do it privately, and you want to teach your school of thought, then that would be the best way to do that. Right. So just a school.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could have other ventures.
It's no surprise the teacher has education as their primary means of benevolence, but.
Yeah. So, but a lot of the funds were going to, a lot of, transgender organizations, and so forth. A lot of
LGBT. Yeah, she definitely did her homework.
Funding. Yeah. A lot of, like, most of it went to, you know, LGBTQ organizations. And, I said this to you before. You know, I'm saying, okay, you know what? Let me try to be balanced on this, and let me not see things from one perspective. You know, people were saying that, you know, the organizers were buying mansions and splurging. And I would say, to support them, well, why not, Joel? Why not? These women worked hard, right? These women worked hard to start a movement. Why can't they benefit from the fruits of their labor? Why not? Why can't they buy a mansion and bless their people? What's wrong with that?
Well, in simplest sense, they didn't pay their organizers $8 million a year, who paid tax on the $8 million, and then buy the house. Because in theory, if you're an $80 million a year organization, you could argue your director earns $1 million. I just made the number up. I don't know. I'm just saying, the point is, the size of your business largely will result in, I need a director who's wise in spending this volume of money. Right? It's the amount of skills required or experience required to spend $1 million is a lot different than spending $80 million efficiently, partially because you're not in a $1 million organization. You could probably do it with five people, and one person's largely a decision maker. In an $80 million organization, you might need 25 people, and managing a staff of different sizes is a much different responsibility. So I'm just saying, in the context of bringing in that much in revenue, if your founding members hadn't been doing this for 20 years and barely made a penny, and you had a level of back compensation now that you've made it as an organization, arguably you could justify it. It would be in line with your charitable purpose. Oh, because paying through payroll, you'd have to argue why it was appropriate compensation. Mm-hmm. But your question is not the reason I answered the way I did is because they didn't do that. They bought them through the entities, which means they never paid any tax on it. The charitable entity bought it with a personal benefit in mind, potentially. Again, sending the money to another charity arguably isn't a problem. The problem is that the donors didn't anticipate that that's what the purpose was. So in reality, the donors to Black Lives Matter could actually sue that the funds going to transgender issues is actually a violation of the fiduciary duty of the directors, because the intention was to spend it in a different manner, or was portrayed that they were spending in a different manner. And again, you could do that based on percentage of spending. Maybe if they spent, let's say, 2% of their budget on Black trans issues, maybe someone could argue that that's reasonable based on, you know, the number of Black population that is trans, right? So again, it comes back to like teasing out how did they do it, and did they align with their charitable purpose? The other issue, though, that sort of relates to what you're talking about is I mentioned individuals claiming it for tax purposes. What her documentary represented was that a lot of the money was going to friends, not directly to friends, but to friends' organizations, friends' charities, and those charities have not filed tax returns.
Okay.
So there's a lot of entities that money was donated to who have not done any filings.
Okay, so you're saying it's okay for them to enjoy the fruits of their labor?
Well, I mean, to some extent, I'm not saying the way that they did it, right? But to my point is that like we can't just oversimplify and go, oh, they don't get to spend any money on
right.
themselves.
Yeah, and that's I was kind of like, well, why not buy a mansion, or as Lecrae said, you know, BLM might take your funds and buy expensive flights. What's wrong with that?
Well, and that's where, is it in line with your charitable purpose? Now, the problem is someone could be like, oh, I needed to go for this flight. And that's where you have to have wisdom at the same time to say, I should probably stop donating to this organization because I don't like how they're spending my money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? And this is why most charities, one of the major things that they show in their financial reports is the percentage they spend on administration versus the percentage they spend on actually doing the work that they want to do. And one of the biggest selling factors is, oh, we only spend 5% of your donation on administration or whatever the percentage is. Because, A, going to Africa and spending money on kids who can't afford to feed themselves was the intention of my donation to World Vision. And so if 50% is going to the staff in Canada, I'm going, is there a better organization than this? Right now, maybe the regulatory atmosphere require whatever, you know, you have to do benchmarking against others. And that's where I go back to, can you justify their salary? Can you justify spending on these organizations in line with your charitable purpose? If you can, you should be promoting it in a way that's demonstrating, hey, we've had a director for 20 years who's basically made $2,000 a year. We decided to give them a bonus of what their salary should have been for the last 20 years because we still only have a payroll of 1%, right? Like you can tease these things out and present them rightfully versus what I think Candace R. Owens was trying to demonstrate was that it's very deceptive. It's very hidden. The manner in which BLM operates as an entity is a good show for getting your donation and zero on the back end. Or, you know, largely the show doesn't match what they do on the back end. And I think it's definitely something that needs to be considered. You know, I would ask how many people, doesn't matter, white, Black, brown, conservative, liberal, supported Black Lives Matter and would question how the funds are spent and now would say maybe I shouldn't keep giving them money. I think, right. You know, she talked through a couple other things where she tried to approach the BLM owners. I think she like got an address, and so she tried to like, you know, walk up to the door, just knock on the door. Hey, can I talk to someone? No, okay, we'll leave, no problem. But the person like tried to make it like she was threatened and felt intimidated, and like all it was just this, you know, persona of a show that eventually led to this girl like deleting her social media because Candace Owen exposed like, hey, look, I was just trying to get an interview to talk through what you're doing. If you're doing something good, I want to know. I want to be able to say back, BLM actually spent your money well. And so my point is that like, I think her documentary just demonstrated that this charity is not, at least has definitely not done anything to build a strong reputation for how it spends its money. It's largely a perception game, like politics, unfortunately, than it is, hey, here's the good we're doing. Please continue to support us.
Right. All right. So what's your two cents? What'd you think of the documentary?
I mean, I thought overall it was informative. I thought that the narration of it was, I want to say minimal enough. And I hope that what I'm trying to say is that like, it wasn't excessively commentated. Like there was a lot of just, here's an interview, here's a conversation, here's, you know, interpret, I don't want to say interpret for yourself, but largely the interview or the conversation or those things spoke for themselves. They didn't have to then like come over top, give you the narrative as to how all these things piece together, and build the story for you. So in that sense, I'm just trying to say it was well done, and I didn't feel like, you know, her agenda was shoved down your throat. I think you sort of said it earlier that you thought she did a good, you were like, why are we doing this? And then you realize like, okay, they're building towards something. And I thought that sort of buildup was done well, in the sense that it didn't take narrative. It was largely woven together well enough through different testimonies and pieces of the story that they were building, telling.
Nice.
What about you? What did you think about the documentary as a whole?
I think it was helpful. I thought it was helpful in regards to the footage that the media didn't release, right? Kind of like a picture's worth a thousand words, and you're like, okay, wow, this adds a new element to my knowledge of the case. Black Lives Matter analysis on how they spent the money was good to see what happened to it. I think, and you've said this before, and you said it numerous times throughout the podcasts that we've done, that, you know, it's better to talk about these controversial issues after the fact, not during the fact, because emotions are riding high. So I thought it was helpful. But I think, you know, sometimes she her bias started to show and was leaning into the questions too much, where they weren't open-ended, but closed-ended.
Like on the interview side, she was sort of loading the
questions. Yeah. They were loaded,
trying to get the answer she wanted.
Yeah. But you already know how these conversations go. So you have to take it with a grain of salt. But I think the evidence was definitely compelling that there was a lot more to this issue, to George Floyd, than we thought. And in hindsight, the whole Black Lives Matter narrative as well, where Black Lives Matter isn't what we thought it was. Now, like you kind of see time, you know, that saying, time will tell.
Yep.
And so I think of the scripture being slow, quick to listen, slow to speak, in James is crucial. Like we're too quick to speak on these controversial issues, and it's better to let a year, two, three go by and look at how this whole thing plays out, and then make your comments and be like, no, I don't think this is being handled correctly. I thought the documentary was good, and I thought it was necessary, and I think everybody should watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a good good point about, like, think about it. It's 3 years later that this came out. And, you know, I know she basically, or maybe 2.5, she basically was, you know, speaking about it super early. It sounded like, and maybe I'm reading into what she showed a little bit, but she, I think it sounded like when the girl from the Young Turks went after her personally for her, like, criticism, she was like, okay, now it's on. Now I want to make sure. Like, it was almost like this documentary was bred from that criticism from the Young Turks. Because basically, I think it was her video that I referenced earlier, when she had put that out. They basically were like, you know, calling her a token black conservative kind of thing. And they attacked her personally. And she sort of made some comment in the documentary about, like, when they went after me, okay, now it was sort of on. And I thought, yeah, the fact that it's, you know, I feel like now is the right time for it to come out. Now, again, if you're a conservative, it's also somewhat strategic because it's far enough away from the next election, you know, so it's, I'm sure there's a little bit of games there too. But at the same time, to your point, enough time has passed. You've allowed the things to settle. You can really now start to judge a lot of the fruit, which, you know, as Christians, hopefully we're more in tune to the fruit of different entities and organizations and realizing, hey, how do we, that's how we should be judging them, not just the things they say. So,
yeah, I agree.
As we wrap it up for the last time, mm-hmm. is there anything on this topic you want to leave the listener with? Any more two cents? I think, nope. We already talked about what you thought about the documentary, but
yeah,
I think Candace Owens is an interesting character. I think that, I like her more now than I used to, probably just because she's become a little more polished, a little bit less, a little bit less of a wild card. And not that that's a bad thing, but, you know, in the sense that, like, even that video from 2 years ago, she probably said some things that were sensationalized a little. Yeah. And I think she does that a little bit less now. But like you said, you know, there's still agendas, there's still biases. But that's inevitable. I think more than anything, it's whether people own them, acknowledge them, and you, as opposed to be deceitful about, where am I coming from? What is my agenda? What am I trying to convey? She was honest at the end, right? She told what she thought happened. I think it's a plausible hypothesis. The facts align, unfortunately, I would say. At the end of the day, I think the documentary was necessary because that one comment that I already showed you or mentioned about that guy who, the prosecutor, right? That just demonstrates the need for something like this to tease out the facts, because clearly a lot of people were blinded by agendas, social movements that they, and again, I go back to my comment. I can't know for certain that this man was given a fair trial.
Right. Right.
And, that's my two cents.
Yeah.
So nice. How are we going to do this for the last time?
Oh, yes. Just thank you, everybody, for listening and following along and supporting through the years. And, you know, we've always left our social media plugs. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at DoGoodToDarnell, DoGUDDA_Darnell. Darnell Samuels on Facebook. Check out my other page on Instagram and TikTok, Mr. Samuels Class.
Darnell's starting a new thing. I like it.
But thank you guys. Thank you guys for your support. And we hope the show was helpful. What about you, Joel?
Yeah, I was gonna say, the Sixth Sense social media may be a little less accessible, but our personal stuff is still out there. TJoelN39 everywhere. I'm back on Instagram. I don't know how they let me use
the same.
Username. I don't understand.
No, the IG algorithm god, you know, had mercy on you. Let you back.
Yeah, basically. No, what that means is I wasn't canceled for any good reason. And so they let me back on to use my, because I think if you get, like, legit let's call it canceled for violating terms, your username is like locked into eternity. I mean, I could be totally wrong. I don't know what I'm talking about, but
yeah,
I basically got back on IG and, you know, I'm on, on Twitter and Facebook, TJoelN39, whatever, Facebook/Twitter/Instagram/. So, if you want our 2 cents, you're going to have to message us personally because, it's the last time.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Six Centers. We love you. Appreciate you guys. Yeah.
Appreciated all the feedback, all the conversations, all the definitely I loved the listener engagement. It definitely gave us some juice to do more things and try more things and ask more questions.
Yep, yep. So,
on that scent.
Six Cents makes change.
But you heard me? Does that make sense?
Madden and Mitchell Media.